The 1995 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 364, How My Profession Affects My Beliefs and Vice Versa, with panelists Mary Beth Raines, Farrah Lines, Sam Stewart, and Stacey Burton.
This is session 364. This panel discussion is on how my profession affects my beliefs and vice versa. There are four of us. My name is Mary Beth Raines. I'm a master's degree in social work. Farrah Lines, who is an attorney from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Sam Stewart, who is president of Wasatch Advisors and I believe is located here in Salt Lake City. And Stacey Burton, who is assistant professor of English at the University of Nevada in Reno. So let me begin. We're hoping to spend maybe 10 minutes apiece or so and then have time for not only questions and answers, but maybe a discussion. I would say this has been a wonderful topic for me to consider, and so let me jump in because there's so little time. After I had typed about 20 pages, I realized this was not going to work. And so I'm just going to give a quick synopsis of that kind of introspection. I would say that profession through a very unusual route, which is my patriarchal blessing. At 9 years of age, for some reason, I was given a patriarchal blessing, and in it there was one line that said that I would be a counselor to women of the church. And so I spent the next years, particularly when I was approaching college, thinking, what did that mean? And I had settled on psychology and then later learned there was a profession of therapy and there was a whole area devoted to family sociology. And so that in some ways kind of geared my interest in one way or another. And so I entered the profession wanting to kind of serve that larger religious or spiritual end, and as I became more developed in it, to relieve suffering. And I would say that I've probably gone through at least three developmental stages, each one of them fairly long. The first, I entered graduate school in 1965, and from the next 12 years or so, I would say that I approached my profession and the church with what I would call a single-view lens, and in which I would entitle briefly that faith, scientific thought, and problem-solving would alleviate suffering. But essentially, there was a simple formulaic view of things. I finished a master's degree in family relationships, which is essentially family sociology at BYU, and over about the next 10 years or 9 years taught family theory courses at the University of Utah in the Family and Consumer Studies department while I was having my children working part-time and so on. And, of course, I mean, there's no way you can't spend a lot of time professionally and have it not affect your beliefs. Originally, I was trying to figure out the amount or assess the degree, and I finally decided there's no way to tell that. It's much like tasting a very good dish, and you're not a cook, you can't tell, and that's probably the mark of it. So the area in which I chose to study, I think, had a particularly heavy impact on my beliefs. I came from a really orthodox conservative family, grew up on the Oregon coast in a very small branch of the church, and took, essentially, a unidimensional view. And the scientific process is one premise. The church's belief about what's real and what's knowing is another premise. But to apply the scientific process to family dynamics is quite another. And over time, I think it wasn't any one particular course or one particular class. It became a gradual shift over time as I started to say, well, you know, this is what the research says. This is what the church says. This is my experience in teaching it. This is my experience in life. And it started to have this whole melting pot phenomena of gradually shifting the way I saw the world. A quick example, I remember very clearly the class I was sitting in at BYU and passing the professor passed out a little questionnaire about democratic family structure and patriarchal family structure. And it became real clear to me within 5 minutes why patriarchal family structure didn't work for me, even though I had grown in it. And from then on, it was simply an interesting process of I didn't believe it. It wasn't something where something big happened or something terrible happened to me. It was just a piece of logic put down in front of me and something shifted. And that one example, I would say, is how I kind of went through the next 10 years as I learned more about family theory and then taught it, was that I would take this single lens and I would keep looking, and pretty soon something would kind of drop out and it wouldn't fit the whole anymore. But I had these fragments and these segments of things that would sit over here and not quite fit in there, but it hadn't accumulated in any kind of critical mass at that point. And so I was. I reached a point where I said, I complain loudly and I obey blindly. by the end of that period. Then around 1977, for a number of reasons, I decided to get a master's degree in social work. And I also, around the same period of time, started questioning everything I ever believed about the church. Now, the two occurred for different reasons. I now believe that I was going through a developmental stage shift, and therefore something in me changed, and therefore I was willing to look at the world differently. But at the time, they looked like two discrete events of beginning to become a therapist, going back into training for another master's degree, and then being passed a master's thesis on the New Mormon history by a friend. And so I started on a long process, which occurred over the next 15, 16 years or so, of questioning everything and trying to get my feet wet and knowing what being a therapist was, and it tried to, in that sense, alleviate suffering from a different angle. And I would say probably what was most helpful during those periods of years in terms of working with both my beliefs, which I was actively trying to do, and then working with the whole practice process of being a social worker and a therapist, was to acquire a number of bifocal lenses, two sets of lenses in which to view the problems I was facing. The first thing I would say is that as I started questioning the church, all the answers to gospel questions became questions to gospel answers. Everything kind of turned itself on its ear, and I didn't have any way to organize all the material. And so over time, the concepts of paradox became very important to me, or other concepts such as process versus content, which I'll get to in just a minute, were also very helpful. So it initially became a way to sort my beliefs, to see that there were paradoxes in the world, that is, incongruities which did not have obvious solutions. And at times there are paradoxes which will never have a solution. They simply are incongruities that are. And then there are other paradoxes, it seems to me, that have a solution, but not at the same developmental stage you are at the moment. Einstein put it well, I think, when he said that most problems cannot be solved at the level in which they were created. They have to be solved at a higher level from which they were created, and it takes a whole developmental process to get there. So as I was asking all of these questions originally, I had a lot of anxiety about them, I had a lot of disturbance about them, and I was completely overwhelmed in terms of becoming a therapist because I knew clearly I didn't know what I was doing, and the amount of suffering I was seeing was incredible. And I have to say that's the other major thing that has really helped me work with my beliefs in the church and in the gospel and the way I view life is simply doing therapy day to day to day, month to month to month, year to year to year, and seeing all the suffering, seeing all the contradictions, seeing all the way things don't fit into categories, trying to understand them at different levels. And as you probably know from the inside of your life, everything doesn't sort itself into neat, easy categories, and that only is that not only is true of everyone. In some cases, the problems are more horrendous, and the suffering is far deeper. And in some ways, there really aren't answers, I don't think. In some things, there aren't that. So I ran across a quote. I can't tell you where I got it that helped me a lot, which is, "Wisdom is born of terrible knowledge." To have to look something in the face you know you don't understand has more pain and suffering to it than you can alleviate, that you have to somehow find ways of living with it and find some ways of helping, even when it can't ultimately be helped. In other ways, I couldn't ultimately solve the problem, right? Shifted my belief, I think, on an experiential basis far more than the knowledge basis that I'd had previously through family sociology and research methods. It was simply being overwhelmed. It's much like a new mother who has one pregnancy and then another pregnancy and then another pregnancy, and pretty soon you've gone beyond your capacity to do it, and your job then is to hang on. It's no longer to be the perfect mother. It's to get fed and clothed, and that's pretty much it without getting mad too often. How many people could raise their hands to that? So just having the experience of doing it gradually eroded away, I have to say, what I would call my religious arrogance at thinking things could all be solved and that they were easy answers and that I truly could make an ultimate difference in some sense. Let me tell you just briefly the things that helped me, that gave me oars to paddle in the rough seas, but even though it didn't look like there was a, you know, a lake to get across anymore. Paradox helped, and it let me see incongruities. The other is, in family systems theory, I have a degree in, not a degree, but a master's degree, a license also in marriage and family therapy, which has been tremendously important to me in terms of having techniques and strategies for how to help people in family context, is that there's an important discrimination between process and content. There's a discrimination between how something happens and what happens. And how that shaped my belief over time is that if you believe that process is really important, that how something happens is important, ultimately how something happens is maybe more important than what happens, that the ultimate test for me over time became, is a gospel principle true, is how it is implemented and how it is lived is more important than the content of that. For example, the issue of morality, sexual morality, I've been interested in sex for a long time, and so that, of course, is one of the things I was interested in. How sex is taught and how it is implemented is really as much a moral and ethical process in the church than what behavior you did or not did not do, how, where you put your hands or did not put your hands, with whom you did it or did not do it. That being treated compassionately in a context of discussion is as moral an issue and explicates morality to me as much as did you do it or not do it. Let me give you a quick example of a bishop who said to a client of mine a number of years ago who had become sexually active after a temple divorce. And he said to her, I can't advise you what to do. I know that sexual experience and loving is entirely important. I also know that as a bishop I can't offer you full activity in the church. I want you to decide that for yourself, because ultimately you have to decide the way the church has split sexuality and spirituality. You have to decide for yourself which is the most important need. Now that process of compassion in the light of deciding what to do right or wrong became, for me, over time, the biggest belief, because in that sense, I'd signed up for my professional belief in process. Now, that isn't to say there aren't absolute rules of, you know, force or violence or coercion and all of those kinds of things, and that's a complex problem. But in any case, that became very important. The other thing that became really quite important was running onto mystical literature at the time I was discussing things within my church questioning. There's a whole field of psychology called transpersonal psychology that is very interested in how the spiritual is connected with the psychological. And there have been writers for probably 20 years now who've taken a good deal of time in the theoretical and then in the clinical area of how do you integrate spirituality to therapy? How do you integrate spirituality into the idea, for instance, of developmental stages psychologically? And for the first time, it felt like I had a big enough oar. Now I had a motor, actually, to help me get across some of these waters in that I now understood and could see, this is a very complex process, but I could now see that a lot of what seemed incongruous stuff to me were simply different things that happened to people or different ways people behaved at different developmental stages. Let me give you quickly the idea of forgiveness. We are told to forgive. How many people do you know who can just forgive something, particularly a big betrayal or trauma, immediately after it happens? I don't know anybody. I've never been able to. You know, the larger betrayals and traumas have taken me actually years, and some of them decades, to finally set to rest in one way or another. It is impossible, actually, at a developmental level that is still a conventional moral level or a child's level. It's impossible to do it. You need to be at a different developmental stage in order to do it fairly quickly, and you need to have had years of practice. And it generally happens in stages. The forgiveness process itself is actually a 6 or 7 stage process in which it occurs at the end of a healing period. It doesn't happen automatically the first because you make a mental decision. So that helped me sort things into developmental stages, or when someone comes and talks about how they're suffering with a particular problem, it helps me to understand what developmental stage they are. And that has helped me, actually, in an odd way, come back with far more compassion to my belief process in the church, in that I can see how different general authorities, and again, this is my lenses and this is my views, see how different general authorities might be at their particular developmental stage of thought. Now, obviously, I can acquire a new level of arrogance, right? Which is, oh, now I understand more than you do because my level of thought is more than whatever. And yet, at truly more mature developmental stages, arrogance goes. You don't pick up new arrogance. That means, oddly enough, you're still back at this other level, where there's still an us and them and a you and me and so on. Which brings me to my third stage, which I've been in about the last 3 or 4 years, that I don't have quite a good grasp on, or what I would even call it, other than to say it's much of a synthesis of the previous years and a use of myself in it, being a therapist and a professional, rather than use of techniques or cognitive strategies or problem solving entirely. And since I don't quite understand it yet, it's a little bit like Alan Watts, who talked about mystical experience, and trying to talk about mystical experience was a little bit like trying to F the ineffable. This new stage actually is a process of being a person in a different way and being in the therapy hour or being in a place different with people than trying to do something or formulate a task that then needs to be solved. And that I've gradually learned that this terrible knowledge that I actually sit with from day to day and hear from people and see people and talk with people about, that I am myself implicated. I also create suffering. I also create suffering in the therapy process. I create suffering among the people in my ward. I create suffering among my children, and I didn't know that until recently. I'd assumed that my good intentions and my right action or my repentance had taken care of it, and now I understand more and more how it, part of that is that we are all implicated. None of us go scot-free, and yet we are still wonderful people. Now all I have to say, is the use of my awareness. I can still solve problems, I can still use concepts, but I only have the beingness I have with myself and with other people. My mission president said, you know, I think psychiatrists and, you know, and therapists aren't really entirely trustable. This was 30 years ago, mind you. And he was right. But anyway, they're not entirely trustable. You know, they're taking over the function that religion used to have. And in fact, Carl Jung called the therapy profession a profession of soul doctors. I think my mission president was right. And it feels like, finally, I'm at a stage where I feel handling with more awe and with more humility this whole process of serving people and helping people, even though I eventually won't be able to solve the problems. Thanks.
As Mary Beth indicated, I'm an attorney. If any of you have ever read any of Brigham Young's talks about attorneys, you're probably saying, what is he doing up there? Because attorneys obviously can't have any beliefs. But we do. And I think attorneys have kind of had the last laugh over the years. You know, we kind of sit back and laugh. If only Brigham had spent a little time with attorneys before his death and done some estate planning, he could have probably saved the church and his family and all of us, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars and lots of grief in trying to sort all of that out. In talking today about this subject, I'd like to first start by differentiating between the church and the gospel, because those have had different influences on my career and my practice. And I'd like to first start by talking about the church or the institutional church and how that's impacted me. I guess the first impact was a very immediate one. After graduating from law school and spending a little time in Washington, D.C., I came out to Albuquerque to start my practice. And I was hired by one of the large law firms there and enjoyed that a lot. But at the time I came out, there were only, I think, three active LDS attorneys in the city. And so I was constantly getting calls from bishops saying, you know, I've got a kid in jail. Could you go get him out? You know, could you preach this funeral, talk to this inactive person that died and didn't have family and those sorts of things. And this kind of church involvement wasn't compatible to a large law firm who wants you to be there at a certain time and not leave till a certain time and get your billable hours in. So after a couple of years, I left the large firm and went out into a smaller firm so that I could have, frankly, the independence to do a lot of the church sorts of things that I was being asked to do and I really enjoyed doing. The second impact has to do with Brother Brigham again. You know, some of his philosophy has come down for more than 100 years. I don't know if you realize, but in the church, well, in the bishop's handbook, there's a specific notation that no church fast offering funds are to be used for legal fees. Isn't that kind of interesting? There's hardly a week goes by, and hasn't for 25 years, when I don't get a call from a bishop saying, I've got one of the bishops, and we have a lot of wards in Albuquerque, saying I've got this family in our ward who's who has some problems, and they're on church welfare, and they've got a legal problem, and I was wondering if you could help them. Well, I know that this isn't the bishop's problem, but, you know, I always kind of like to tweak them, and I'd say, well, give me some more about their situation. I need to know a little bit more. And then I say, well, now I understand you're paying their landlord, and you're paying their TV repairman, and you're paying their mechanic, and you're paying their doctor, and you're paying their dentist, but you want me to do it for free. And, you know, and I'm not suggesting that Mary Beth and other professionals don't do things quite often in the church for free, but I suspect that we attorneys are the only ones that never get paid for anything that we do in the church for bishops. Another example of how the institutional church has affected my practice. Back in the 70s when I started practicing law, the mores of that time indicated that a young girl who got pregnant just did not keep her baby and would generally put it up for adoption. And there were just lots of adoptions being handled, and literally I was placing anywhere from 5 to 10 babies a month during that period of time, because the LDS members and clients were sending young girls to me. And that really wasn't my area of practice, but once you do a couple, then the word kind of gets around. So I was doing a lot of placement of babies, and all I was doing was just charging my fee, and then the girl was just getting her expenses paid. But all of a sudden, one week, here comes a church bulletin from Salt Lake, you know, the weekly bulletin, saying no LDS attorney should be involved in private adoptions. Well, this kind of shook me, and it also shook our stake president, because I had just placed a baby for adoption with him and his wife. And so he called Salt Lake and said, well, you know, tell us about this. Why has this happened? And they said to him, well, we've had some problems here in Utah and in California with some LDS attorneys being involved in private adoptions, and they weren't right, and it's caused bad light on the church, so we don't want any LDS attorneys to do any adoptions. Well, our stake president kind of tried to argue with them a little bit, but they wouldn't flinch. But he came back and he said, well, Farrell, you and I are on the same wavelength. We would rather see these kids go to LDS families than go to non-LDS families, so just keep it up, and if there's any repercussion, then I'll go to bat for you. And I was on the high council at the time, and so as a bit high profile, so I had to be careful. And so that went along for quite a while, but then the next thing that happened is, for some reason, the church changed LDS Social Services Director for New Mexico, sent a fellow down who was a nice fellow but had a very abrupt, abrasive personality. So all of a sudden we had these young girls and their parents going in to LDS Social Services, the LDS ones, and they would come out crying because of the harsh treatment that they felt he was giving him. So they would come over and ask me if I would be willing to place the baby in an LDS family, and I would do that. Well, the word got back to him that just a lot of girls were doing that. He thought that I was trying to undermine what he was doing, so he called Salt Lake and filed a report. So the state president and the regional representative got a call from Salt Lake saying, you need to take disciplinary action against him because he's against church policy. Well, luckily the stake president and the regional representative went to bat again and explained the situation and that I hadn't done anything wrong. So we didn't hear anything more on that, and I stayed on the high council. But you can see how some of these things are a bit disconcerting when you think you're doing well and right, and you get in a bit of trouble. The next example I guess I can give is in the area of divorce. And again, that really wasn't my practice. I was really a civil defense attorney doing courtroom litigation. But early on, a family in our ward was getting a divorce, and one of the other asked me to handle it. And then the word gets around. And since I was one of the few attorneys, I started getting just more than my share of divorces in the church community there. And that was kind of awkward also, because the men or women would come in, whoever wanted the divorce, and when they would come in, I would always first say, well, have you been to counseling? Would counseling help? Could, you know, what kinds of things have you done before we do something so drastic as to file for divorce? But in most cases, they had really, you know, done all of those channels, and there just wasn't much left. But as they would come in, they would tell these horrible stories of spousal abuse, either physical or emotional, child abuse, sometimes going on for lots of years. And they had counseled with their bishop for lots of years in many cases also. And our poor bishops are wonderful men, but they really kind of have, you know, a couple of weights on their legs. First of all, you know, they're counseled by the church that they're not to advise divorce. Secondly, they're male, and they're priesthood members. And when a woman would come in with some really serious allegation of abuse on the part of a priesthood member who might be an elder's quorum president in that ward or maybe even the bishop's own counselor, the bishop just would not be believing and would consider her too often a hysterical woman or overreacting and tell her to go back and pray and everything would work out well. Well, I would counsel them that they were also entitled to their own personal revelation or inspiration, independent of the inspiration the bishop was getting for his wards, and they needed to act on what they also felt was right. Well, in most cases, this had already happened, but they need someone just to verify or ratify what they were feeling all along. And so I would help them, and we would file for the divorce. And it was wonderful just to see the relief that after so many years, this person could see the light at the end of and realize that they could finally get out of such a dysfunctional, and sometimes just a terrible, terrible situation. However, as invariably would happen, I would then get a call from the bishop saying, "What are you doing? I've been counseling this couple for 2 years, and we're making progress, and you're getting rid of an eternal family here." And not only would I get calls from bishops, but from elders' quorum presidents, and even from Relief Society presidents. Well, knowing the inside story, the confidential story of what had gone on, I generally didn't lose a lot of sleep over these calls, although it was a bit disconcerting. And in the bishop's cases, I wasn't too worried because I knew that even though they were angry at me that week, it would just be a couple of weeks since they would need a favor again, and so all would be forgotten and forgiven. So that worked out. Let me see, where was I here? Got a little bit ahead of myself here. Now I'd like to shift on how my profession has influenced my belief. I need to preface by telling you, I guess, that I'm from a small Mormon community in southern New Mexico in a really isolated valley. I grew up in an LDS community there, very conservative community, as most small LDS communities are. And I early on had a reaction to the way I grew up there. First of all, I saw how we as an LDS people treated the Mexican Americans who lived in a segregated part of our valley, and that really bothered me. Then during those times as I was growing up also, I saw that the John Birch Society and Brother Benson kind of took control of the Farm Bureau. And the magazines and the pamphlets that were coming into our farmers' homes every week were just what I considered terrible, terrible things, with simplistic answers to all of these questions, lack of tolerance for people that were different from us. And I really had a hard time, and I really kind of rebelled toward that, at least intellectually, and didn't know what to do about it, but decided that I really needed to get out of that small valley and that I really wanted to help some of these people that we were really oppressing as a church and as a church community. And I looked around and decided, well, maybe, the legal profession is the way to do that. So I, early on, when I was in mid-school, I decided I had to be an attorney, that was the only way I could do it. So that's how my belief system, has kind of had some bearing on what I did for a living and how I did it. This then even kind of became a little bit more interesting when I went to BYU and was there under President Wilkinson. And again, there was another level of rebellion seeing what went on there in kind of an institutional church situation. But after going to law school, after marrying, after starting my family and settling back into a married ward kind of for the first time in my life, I realized that I really wanted to fit in and I wanted our family to fit in. And to do that, you couldn't just stand up every time someone gave a lesson and some simplistic answer to some complex problem because, all of a sudden you're a heretic, and you lose effectiveness and you lose your voice if you do that. So I had to learn kind of, by hit and miss not to do that. But my law practice, frankly, was the thing that saved me there. I could just be quiet on Sundays and I could gulp and I could go along and I could smile and I could fit into our ward so that it was comfortable for me and for my wife and for my children. But during the week, I could realize as I was tackling problems from people, a ratification of my own beliefs that, in fact, there aren't simple answers to a lot of of problems in the world or with people, and that we don't live in a black and white world, and that things aren't black and white like we had in all of our lessons, that really the world is full of grays and varying degrees of grays. And that was helpful to me to be able to continue to be active by having the Sunday experience, but then having that modified a bit by what I was doing in my practice and what was happening every day of my life. Let me talk a little bit about my beliefs as it's altered my profession or my approach to my profession, and I think that's important also. As I mentioned earlier, the Mormon community is a very small percentage of the total community in Albuquerque, even though we have three stakes, so we're not terribly small in terms of numbers. We're very small in terms of a percentage. Although I've never tried to wear my Mormon on my sleeve, I've always tried to let everyone know that I was a Mormon, and you know, and all the judges in town know that I am. Most of the other attorneys do, and in casual conversation, I try to let my clients know that I was Mormon. And knowing that I was one of the few Mormons in town, and so I was somewhat high profile, I've always kind of considered myself an ambassador of sorts for the church, because as people would see me in different situations doing different things in the community, I was kind of the only Mormon they knew, and so I was kind of exemplary. So I always tried to be very careful about what I did in terms of what am I doing and how is that going to affect the church or how people look at the church. Being kind of one of the few people, a few Mormons that a lot of these people would have known, of course I would get the standard questions right off the bat, you know, well, does your church still believe in polygamy? And, you know, why don't you let blacks into your church? And our minister tells us you're not Christian, so what do you believe in? And, of course, the worst one, you know, why are you drinking a Coke? I thought that Mormons didn't drink any colas. And, you know, that would just drive me up a wall because there's so much more to us than a few people thinking we don't drink colas. But that's all part of what goes along with kind of, you know, being one of the only Mormons that anyone's going to know. And so you have to be very careful about that. Really, I think that my profession and my belief is kind of like Martha Bradley said last night, are kind of entwined like a vine around a wall. You just have a hard time really sorting them out, and I think that that's important. In my practice, I've had a lot of jury trials over the years, and I'm really a competitor, and I like to win, and I can't stand not to win, so I kind of do everything I can to win. But that's kind of hard, too, because in the civil field, I find that most of the time I'm trying cases against newer attorneys. And that's the only reason we're going to trial is because they're kind of new, and they don't know how to value their case. I do a lot of work for insurance companies, and we know how to value a case, and I'm paid to know what a jury's going to do, and I'm seldom wrong. And so I offer an amount of money, and if they won't take it, then we go to trial, and we generally win. But since they're kind of new, you know, it's really easy to take advantage of them. And I can get into the courtroom and I could just run all over them. And you know, that's the real, you know, gut feeling to do it, you know. But then on the other, and also, you know, there's the oath that we take that we're supposed to do everything that we can to help our client within, you know, the terms of the law. But I always have to sit back and moderate that and say, well, I still want to help my client and I've got to win at all costs, but not at the cost of taking advantage. So I have to sit back and oftentimes just kind of gently give some advice or something to the other attorney to kind of help them along. Another thing I found that in the legal profession that I've had to be very careful about, in most cases when you're having a case with another attorney, you're quite professional, and no matter how heated you get in the courtroom, whether it's in just a hearing or a trial, you come out of that and you shake hands and you go away as friends. But once in a while, you get an attorney who's very emotionally involved in the case, and then it becomes very difficult. And afterwards, I can tell that they're very angry at me. You know, I'm the personification of the evil that's happened here. And so I try to call them afterwards, you know, and put it back on a professional note. And if that doesn't work, even maybe follow it up with a letter. And I don't know a lot of attorneys that do that, and I'm not saying that to brag, but only that I feel that obligation because I don't want them angry at me, because I feel if they're angry at me, they're angry at the church or are going to have bad feelings about the church, knowing that I'm Mormon. So, you know, that's been a dilemma. Another dilemma, early on in my practice, we didn't have a public defender system, so I handled a lot of criminal cases. And that was back in the days of there were a lot of heroin addicts and a lot of marijuana cases with what at that time we called hippies. My boys don't like me to use that word anymore because that doesn't mean anything to their generation. But anyway, it was a situation again where I could go to trial And I wouldn't, and I wouldn't let my client take the stand, obviously, if he told me he was guilty or if I really thought that he was guilty. But I could just sit back, and the state has to prove their case, and I could always sit back with sloppy police work and convince a jury of doubts, and I could get a lot of them off. I would get home at night, and my wife would say, well, what'd you do today? And I'd say, well, I've got another heroin addict back on the street. And she would say, well, how do you feel about yourself, you know? And so I'd have to sit back and take note again and take stock, you know, is this really, you know, doing well? And then I realized again, you know, our legal system has its flaws, but it's still the best. And if I ever got in trouble, I would certainly want to have a jury of my peers, no matter whatever. I think my time is gone, but really the most important thing, or one of the most important things that I think as people, and especially as an attorney that we have in our life, is to work for a long period of time, however it takes, to get a reputation for honesty and trustworthiness. And I think that my church and my beliefs have really helped me to try to do that, and I continue to try and hope that someday when my career is over that people can look at me and that I've been successful and that I can have left that legacy for myself and for the church and even for my family. Thanks.
Well, that was most enjoyable. This has been a real treat for me to be here. I probably should admit this, but I haven't attended Sunstone in, oh, maybe 10 years. It's been a long time, and I was telling my wife on the way down that, you know, there's probably going to be more people on the panel than there are in the audience, and so it's going to be pretty laid back and relaxed. And much to my surprise, we've got a pretty sizable crowd, and I appreciate your being here. A couple of things from Farrell and Mary Beth have helped me crystallize some of my thoughts, and they're in need of crystallization because both of them have obviously written out in some detail, and I've got a few notes here to come from. I hope I pull them together, but One of the things that surprised me a little bit in their two talks, and I almost call it a revelation, is as I was thinking about the business of your beliefs affecting your profession and saying, well, obviously the most basic way they might affect your profession is that you choose your profession because of your beliefs. And as I was talking about this with Diane, I said, well, you know, that doesn't really happen to many people, I don't think. I mean, I thought about the example of a priest or a nun where your beliefs directly led to your profession. And then we've got a daughter that is trying to get into the field of poverty medicine. And it's very clear, knowing her, that is a direct outflowing of her beliefs. But I thought, well, this is a fairly rare phenomenon. It's interesting that the first two people on the panel have pretty much said, no, I got into my profession to put my beliefs into practice. Unfortunately, I can't claim that somewhat high ground, I think. I got into my profession. I'm not sure why, and there's a whole bunch of things, and Mary Beth could probably get the real reasons out of me, but I don't think it has much to do with certainly my religious belief system. I would like to spend most of my time on how my profession affects my belief. And here, I really have had two professions in my life. The first incarnation, if you will, was as a university professor. So it's going to be real interesting to me to hear what Stacy has to say. But in many ways, I would say that the university professorship was a continuation of what I experienced in my home growing up and what I experienced in the church growing up. And some of the same kinds of thoughts, although, you know, I'm of the right sex, Mary Beth is of the wrong sex. So everything seemed to be going my way, and, you know, the patriarchal authority and so forth. And it was pretty much, you know, yeah, my rightful role in life is to be the male patriarch, as was my father, and as was the bishop or the stake president or the president of the church, and that meant having gone through school and so forth and acquired a wife and a family, that I'd be pretty much the rule maker, and I'd kind of hand down things and say the way things went. And that was certainly my experience as a professor. I've thought often as a professor is kind of a chance to play God, you know, for 4 hours a week, 10 weeks a quarter, because students are there and they're really compelled. I mean, you've got the power. You've got the power of that grading pen, you know, A, B, C, D. You've got ultimately the power of the degree. Do they get out of there? And so there is a lot of, if you will, political kowtowing by the students that may be a little more tuned in. And then there's a lot of, you know, I've butted heads a few times with students and kind of pulled rank and said, hey, I'm the guy that gets to say what you're worth, in essence. About a little over 10 years ago, I changed professions. And what I changed into was being a money manager, and I don't know, I think images come to our mind when we talk about a therapist or an attorney, and most of us have had those interactions. Maybe not so many people have had interactions with a money manager, but I would say that my profession involves two things. On the one hand, it involves an evaluation of investments, and in my case, it's always common stocks. And should I put my money, or should my clients put their money into General Motors, or should they put it into Ford? And so there's a tremendous amount of evaluation that goes in that part of the profession. The other part of the profession really has to do with communicating with people and trying to get them to adopt a financial plan that makes sense for themselves. And I've spent a lot of my time, actually, both as a professor and now as a professional money manager, watching people kind of do very, very dumb things with their money. And I've viewed it as my role, and by dumb things, I don't simply mean not signing up with Wasatch Advisors. I mean things like taking life savings that are relied upon for retirement at a point very close to retirement and plunging into something of very questionable on the surface. You know, why on earth would you even be thinking about making this kind of an investment at your particular stage in life and given your obligations, responsibilities, hopes, wishes, and desires? And it happens way too often, and obviously that part of the role is, if you will, trying to understand, counsel, guide, direct people in a way that will prove beneficial to them. So those, I think, are the two key elements. Anyway, so I took the job as a money manager, and I was also CEO. And basically my assumption was, okay, this is going to be a straight line from father to priesthood leader to university professor to CEO. Well, guess what? It is not a straight line. And I'm sure you've seen plenty of movies and read plenty of books where the CEO looks pretty much like the patriarch incarnate. That has not been my experience at all. And for the first two or three years at Wasatch, I used to say, the church that I go to on the Sabbath day is merely incidental. The real church that I go to is the church that I go to Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And it's that church of trying to work with people, and in this case, many of the people, my own employees, but also clients and people that you're trying to, whose companies you're trying to analyze. But it was abundantly clear that this was not a place that you could pull rank. And it was I had a laugh when Farrell talked about his somewhat sharp-spoken social services administrator, because I'm sure that some of the people that I interacted with came away thinking that I was like the sharp-spoken social services administrator. And it quickly became evident to me that what I had assumed to be true really wasn't true, or wasn't cutting it, or wasn't operative in the world that I wanted to live in, or the world that I was in. I'm not quite sure how to describe it, but pulling rank simply wasn't an effective strategy. And so I had to relearn, rethink, reevaluate. And I loved Mary Beth's description of her saying, well, what I've lost is my religious arrogance. And I certainly feel much less confident about my capabilities in an interpersonal setting than I did 10 years ago. The flip side of that coin is I think that I am, infinite is overstatement, but substantially better at interpersonal skills. And that's simply the very pragmatic sense of what works and what doesn't work. If you want to have bright, capable, talented people working with you, they're simply not going to accept that I'm the boss and you do it my way. I mean, I'm totally confident that you can assemble a team of flunkies that my way or the highway goes, but not a team of good people. So let me just, I do want to work one scripture into this. it's simply the, I think probably that the 121st section of the Doctrine and Covenants has been proven in my case over and over that whenever you begin to exercise I'm losing the words, but in the least degree of coercion, amen to the priesthood or authority. And I'm taking this entirely out of religious context. I mean, you lose. I mean, you might be able to force somebody to do something, but you lose all credibility, you lose all basis of doing it. Now, let me just quick give a few. If I can assume that the Sunstone crowd is rather liberal, maybe that's a bad assumption, but the media's portrayal of businessmen is just totally bankrupt. It's certainly been my experience that the businesses that succeed in the long run have nothing to do with J.R. Ewing. In fact, the businesses that succeed in the long run are the businesses that you would love to work for, because they have a culture that is respectful of human values. They have a culture that is long-term oriented in its thinking, and they have a culture that is going to be productive in the long run. And essentially, that's what we try to do when we look for an investment to make. We say, we're trying to find an acorn today that is going to be an oak tree tomorrow. And you don't get from an acorn to an oak tree by using power relationships or pulling rank. You get from an acorn to an oak tree by being careful and sensitive to all of the interests involved. And that has been confirmed I can't tell you how many times. The converse of that, I had to laugh. One of the, I think it was actually in the Salt Lake Hilton, I appeared on a panel at a Salt Lake entrepreneurial, the young entrepreneurs, or somebody had brought a guy into Salt Lake named Barry Ziskin. And Barry had a company, this is a public company called ZBest. And they were, somebody remembers them, or anyway, they were involved in consumer electronics, and he was a very impressive speaker. He was a young guy. I mean, he's 26 years old, and he's head of this multi-million dollar company, and he got up there and my way or the highway, and I tell my people how it is, and so forth. And, you know, it turned out the whole thing was a fraud, and any investors that put their money at lost every single penny. And obviously, you might have been impressed with the guy, but you never would have thought this is somebody that I want to put my money with or invest or kind of live with. I think the I'm looking at the watch here. I do want to maybe offer one final anecdote, and the final anecdote would be kind of a story of two companies, and these companies are both in the funeral home industry, and they're two different ways of doing business, essentially. One of the companies is Service Corp, and they have chosen to do business in a way that is very power-oriented, and basically both these companies are in the business of consolidating funeral homes. It's a business that there's limited future in, often for the mortician, the guy that runs the funeral home, because it's not a very popular profession. He's getting ready to die, and nobody's going to take over. And so many of these funeral homes get sold, but by the same token, the guy says, I've built a business, I've built a name, I want to see this business survive beyond me. And so there's a lot of sellouts in the business. And basically, Service Corp is operated with a take it or leave it. You know, here's our bid. If you don't accept it, we're going to come and build a funeral home across the street. And the company has done okay, but they've sort of floundered. The competitor is a company called Lowen Group, where interestingly, the head of Lowen Group came from the funeral home profession, and that is actually a tremendously difficult profession, because you're dealing with people at the worst time in their lives. They've just lost a loved one, and yet you're trying to get some closure, some business arrangements, a funeral, and so forth. They're very, very difficult, and my hats are off to people in the profession. Anyway, Ray took that skill gained as a funeral director into his negotiations with the other businesses that he came in contact with, and has been wildly successful in getting people to join him merely because they have the sense, the funeral director say, hey, here's a man that is going to take care of me. And so my final concluding message would be that I have seen really and truly how the essence of the gospel, which I do believe is mutual respect, is what allows me to succeed, because I don't think one can be a good evaluator or judge unless you are grounded, centered, if you will, unless you're a pretty solid person yourself. And that the people that ultimately succeed in business are themselves those who are putting gospel principles into action. And I do see the dilemma. I have a quote I'd like to close with. This is from Susan Velaskovic, and she's just talking. The title of the article is quite interesting, Decision-Making to Go Way of Ancient Tribes. And she's in effect saying this industrial revolution world that we live in is going to pass. As the new culture emerges, we will have to give up the security of our organizational charts, titles, and permanent furniture placement. Instead, we will find our security in our skills, value systems, and ability to negotiate effective solutions with our coworkers. And that is, I would just say amen to that, because I think that's the biggest thing that I have learned from my profession. Thank you.
I can talk fast, but I'll probably still run a couple minutes over. I was born and raised in La Grande, Oregon, and went to high school in Boise, Idaho, and did an undergraduate and master's degree at BYU, and then did a master's degree and PhD at Cornell, and then I moved to Reno, Nevada. See, I can do it fast. And when I moved to Reno, the second Sunday I was there, I went to church, and I met a woman in my ward who came up to me, and she said, "Why did you move to Reno?" And she said, "I haven't met you. I want to meet you." And I said, "I taught at the university." And she paused, and she looked at me, and she said, "So are you a professor?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "I've never met a professor before." Now, once I got to know this woman, I learned that she was a college graduate, that her husband was a physician, that her husband was an adjunct faculty at the university, and I think she's probably met a lot of professors before. I think she had never met a professor before who was in her ward, who was female, and who was younger than she was. And I have thought a lot, however, I've thought a lot about her comment, and I've thought a lot about the contradictions that lie behind that. There are a lot of ways I could frame these comments today. What I decided to do was put them in sort of two sections. The first is about how the contradictions are perceived in what might be seen as my double identity as a professor and as a Mormon. And the second is how I experience that identity, which is not quite as contradictory as everybody else seems to perceive it as being. The first part is this idea of Mormon identity in an academic or intellectual life, living in a paradoxically constructed space, an almost implausible one. It is no secret on campuses that religious conservatism of all sorts is seen as suspect, dangerous, and laughable, and that Mormonism is seen by many as an obvious instance of conservative close-mindedness, particularly regarding gender. I could list a whole list of anecdotes, and anybody who's been on campuses lately could. I'll mention two very briefly. One is the experience of a friend of mine, a graduate student at Cornell, who had a professor whose jaw hit the floor when she found out that a student in her feminist psychoanalytic theory course was Mormon, and she said, "I didn't know they let you go to graduate school." Actually, I think she thought that Mormon women were not allowed to go to universities. So that student did some educating of the professor, but it was also an extremely awkward moment for the student. At the end of my second year in Reno, I was at dinner with two colleagues, one of whom was a senior colleague in another department, a person who has been a gracious friend to me and who is also extremely outspoken. And she turned to me, and she had been telling me about a Mormon student she had who had written a paper suggesting that the problem with the character in a 16th century Spanish work was that this character did not have a proper relationship with his father in heaven. And she was telling me she thought that was sort of odd, and I told her kind of what I thought of her student's interpretive skills. And she looked at me and she said, "You know, I have been watching you while you are here to see if your religion has undue influence on your work." She says, "But I don't think it does." And again, a very awkward situation in many ways. In the 1990s, in the intellectual world, a very large question is the question of situating oneself, about thinking about where I do read from, where I think from, and where I experience from. And that with this has come the irony that in some ways being a Mormon in the academy is much different, or at least can be different, than it was a few years ago. And I'll get to that in a few moments. Now to come at it from the other angle for a second. It is no secret that in many wards anti-intellectualism is alive and well in the church, and that the humanities are seen by many people as a particular side of liberal decadence, if not degeneracy. If you came to the ward I live in, you could hear a counselor in the bishopric speak somewhat fervently against the study of philosophy, and you could be in the hear the discussions that I have heard, such as the one in Relief Society a few years ago, when people were talking about reading the scriptures. And I mentioned the example of a friend of mine who had called me late at night rather distressed because she found the Doctrine and Covenants boring to read. Now, I didn't stop at that point. I went on and explained how you could find ways to make it interesting. What I thought was interesting was that the minute it ended, my visiting teacher came over looking at me rather soberly and said, "But you don't really think it's boring, do you?" and we moved on to another topic. But or the comment that occurs whenever people find out that I teach 20th century literature, and I've been asked this many times, so I sort of have a standard answer. They'll say, "Well, you teach 20th century literature. Isn't there like a lot of profanity and sex in that?" And I say, "Well, you know, the people I know in real life, a lot of them swear and a lot of them have sex. It doesn't really bother me if that's in the fiction." So I don't know. This fall I'm teaching a feminist theory course. We'll see how that goes over. In the 1990s, however, it strikes me that we are at a point where it may be becoming easier to be a Mormon in the academy than an intellectual in the church. And my second part of comments, I think, touch a little bit on that. While it is the vantage point of many other people that there are contradictions between my intellectual and religious lives, as I experience them, there is less contradiction. This doesn't mean that all of these things don't cause me stress and grief and late email conversations, but it does mean that I perceive it, I guess, differently than I feel that it is sometimes perceived. Intellectually, the things that interest me in my work are how humans name and make sense out of their experiences, how they write fiction in doing that, how they theorize language, how they theorize how the world works, how they narrate their encounters with self, with other, with world, and with the divine, and how we as hearers and readers of those experiences understand them and re-narrate them, how meaning occurs in a process, how it isn't something that is fixed or set in cement, although my students occasionally would like it to be. What we joke about is, and many literature professors joke about, is the student who feels that what the teachers do is reveal the hidden meaning, like we have them written in the margin. My favorite teaching evaluation of all time was the student who said that my favorite part of the class was when you revealed the hidden meanings, as though it was a moment at the end of class where I sort of flashed them, and there it was, and they could see it, and they knew what it was. But meaning isn't like that. It occurs in a process, it changes, and that's what I enjoy about my work. In that sense, I find a great deal of congruity between what matters most to me in my profession and what matters most in my religion. To me, I think my task as a professor is to help others and to help my students to think critically about language and to think critically about human experience. It is the task of religion, it seems to me, to help people to live responsible and caring lives, informed lives, and to give comfort to them as they try to do that. In essence, I guess I see literature, religion, and theory all as ways of reading experience, and also all as readings that are in need of further interpretation. When I was a master's degree student at BYU, I was teaching freshman English, and one of the students in my class was from my ward at home. She was 2 years younger than I, and she'd put off taking freshman English as long as possible because she was scared of it, so she took it from me. I guess she thought that would be a safe experience or something. And the reader we had an excerpt in it from Fascinating Womanhood, and it was there in order for us to look at it and look at things like overblown rhetoric and really screwy logic, things like that. And we talked about it, and it was actually always one of the most fun days of the semester. But afterwards, the student came up to me, and she said, "Thank you for doing that in class." She said, "You know, my mom gave me a copy of that book. I think there's like a junior version called Fascinating Girl. I don't know. My mom never. I will say this right now. She's here. I want everyone to know this. My mother never gave her children anything like this." At any rate, her mother had given her the Fascinating Girl, Fascinating Woman, whatever it was. And she said, "I read that book. I hate that book. But I didn't know why I hated it. I didn't know how to say I hated it. I didn't know what to do except that I didn't like it." And she said, "Now I understand. Now I can talk about it." A couple of closing thoughts. After spending half my life in universities and all of it in Mormonism, I find that religion, belief, Mormon culture, literature, cultural theory, a host of varied histories, and all the TV I've ever watched, all coexist and intermingled in my mind. They are simply not strictly separable, and I think all are richer for it. It's a richness I wouldn't trade away, though it can be wearing and wearying at times. One byproduct of this is that I cannot sit in church and not think about theory. I also cannot read theory and not think of Mormon stuff. There was one point where I was watching a TV show with my youngest sister. It was just some dumb sitcom. And at the end, they had the most contrived ending I've ever seen. And I commented on it. I said, "This guy was totally in trouble, and he got off the hook because this girl showed up miraculously and saved him." I said, "It was a funny show, but such a canned ending." She just looked at me and she said, "Can't you just watch the show?" And about 20 minutes later as we were driving down the street, she looked over and she said, "I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. I forgot it's normal for you to think like that." because she's a CPA, and she said, "I just don't think like that." She said, "But it's normal for you. It's okay." I said, "Well, all right." So we dealt with that. But I simply cannot. All of that is part of who I am, and it's part of how I read. It means that I read theory differently than my colleagues do, and it means that I can contribute to them by adding what I have to bring. Two quick things at the ending. I know we've run over a little bit on time. A couple of years ago, for the first time, I wrote something about Mormonism, and it was a paper that combined much many ideas from the work I had been reading for my job and the theory I had been teaching and ideas about Mormonism I had had for a long time. The most difficult thing I did with that paper was ask some of my colleagues to read it on campus. It wasn't difficult because I didn't trust them. They were good friends of mine. It was difficult because I didn't know what they would think. And I talked myself into it eventually. They read it, and I was very moved by their responses. A number of them told me that they appreciated my effort at taking the theory we use and expanding it to real life and to expanding it to something that mattered to me. I also had another experience, and I'll close with this one. Recently, a discussion on email made me think about things I had written in the journals that I kept from age 12 to 21. So I went back and looked at them, which is an experience that many of you may have had. It is at once entertaining, mortifying, and sometimes rather sobering. What intrigued me this time as I looked through them was the period from age about 16 to 19. I had noticed before and had always said that this was the period when I most tried on conventional Mormon language and tried most to sort of fit myself to it. And so I already knew that was sort of the scariest part of the journals. As I looked back at them this time, what struck me most was that that is the point where my voice came closest to disappearing in those journals. There were recognizable strands of the voice that had been there from 12 to 15 or 16, but they were so saturated with church voices that it was sometimes very hard to hear Stacy in there. I think it is no accident that it is at that point, at the point of about 19, that what starts to emerge from those journals is a better version, I think, of my voice, a voice that was influenced by literature and by critical thinking and by theory, a voice that helped me to shape my own voice in dialogue with Mormon voices rather than simply being subsumed by them. I guess I'd close by saying that I think my profession has made me a better consumer of Mormonism, and I think my Mormonism has made me a better professor. Thanks.